Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Addisk. I'm sitting in for Melody Cedarstrom. She's not here today. She's not here on financial survival. She claims she went to Thanksgiving party yesterday, and she's still at that location. And I just want to say, if there's one thing I can't stand during the holiday season, is people who can't handle their pumpkin pie. You understand? So we're going to do a public service announcement from the PPPA. That's the Pumpkin Pie Producers Association. And they remind you that during the holidays, know when to say no when it comes to pumpkin pie. I think Melody's just napping. But in any case, I'm stuck with a job, so I've got to do the market report and rest, that sort of thing. And I also want to remind, I want to tell folks that the Internet seems to be running a little slow today. And I connect to the producers, the producer by means of the Internet. And my access to the Internet going up on websites and URLs seems a little bit slow. My Skype connection seems a little bit funky. Apparently, that suggests to me that people are staying home and they're not out shopping. They're staying home and watching pornography on the Internet rather than performing their civic duty to go out and buy something. Now, it's not good information. We don't know this to be true, but it appears possible at this moment. Let's start with a market report. Gold is up $7 for the day, and we closed early. It's up to $1,253 per ounce. Silver's up 27 cents to $20.13 an ounce. Platinum is up $2 to $1,368 per ounce. Palladium's up $2 to $7.25. Dow Jones is down 11 points to 16,086. NASDAQ is up 15 points to 4,059, almost 60. New York Stock Exchange off 0.23 triviality to 10,183. U.S. dollar index is up 0.09 to 80.66. And crude oil is up 48 cents to $92.78 per barrel. Put that in perspective, a little bit of weekly perspective. Gold is up from 1,243 last week to 1,252, so it's up for the week today. 1,252 today, 1,253 actually. Silver is up from 1,983 last Friday to 2,003 today. Platinum is down since last Friday by, what, $4? No more than that. from 1389 to 1358. It's down around $31 for the week. Palladium is up $7 for the week from 712 to 719. Crude oil is down for the week, $2. The U.S. dollar index is just slightly down from 80.67 last Friday to 80.66 today. You could say it's just flat. That's not enough of a difference to notice. So I'm not sure. Does any of it mean anything, or are they just numbers? You know, the way the world works right now, a lot of this is just numbers, and it doesn't seem to have, you know, a significant meaning that you can rely on, because everybody's lying. You know, for example, the Thanksgiving binge. We'll talk about numbers, and it's not just falsified by the government. We even find retailers falsifying numbers. Here's an article, it appeared on Yahoo Finance. And the headline is, "Ignore Black Friday Giant Hype Fest and Huge Consumer Orgy." This is from a guy named Barry Ritholtz. The holiday season represents about 20% of the total retail industry sales, and that's according to the National Retail Federation. For that reason, Black Friday, considered the biggest shopping day of the year, is a major deal. How the day goes will be subject of much discussion, debate, and media attention. In fact, maybe you've already heard about how retailers and those watching the economy are concerned that this holiday season may be the worst since 2009. Since we don't get formal data about Thanksgiving weekend sales until weeks later, after the companies and government statisticians have crunched the numbers, we rely on various projections and surveys to figure out how it went. In other words, we don't really know what happened yesterday. Right? Individual stores they know whether or not they had a good day, a bad day, whether they met, exceeded, or failed to meet their expectations and hopes of sales for that day. They understand, but nobody knows what's happened on a national basis. We have projections, we have polls and whatever from which we can deduce certain implications, but the truth is nobody actually knows. Barry Ritholtz, CIO of Ritholtz Wealth Management, said for the most part they have nothing whatsoever to do with retail sales, how retail sales are actually going, and he's talking about all of these projections and surveys and polls. Ritholtz warns, really advises, that he thinks the sales on Thanksgiving Day and Black Friday won't be impressive, and that we should wait for later sales that may present extraordinary savings and bargains. So maybe some of you have been out on the street. You went shopping yesterday. You're shopping today. Maybe you have a better feel for it. Here's an article from Reuters. Will U.S. Thanksgiving shopping binge become Black Friday hangover? An early start to this year's U.S. holiday shopping season may not necessarily ring up bigger holiday sales for retailers. Eager to entice cautious consumers, and retail offers sales on Thanksgiving Day. The Macy's flagship store opened at 8 p.m., the first time ever on an American holiday. As a result, some U.S. shoppers may have hit the malls and stores on Thanksgiving rather than during the traditional Black Friday blitz. In other words, they were in the stores yesterday rather than today. By late morning, however, the number of shoppers in many stores closely resembled a normal Saturday rather than the usual frenzied Black Friday kickoff. I'm saying that today, late morning, they got some people. It looks like a normal Saturday. It's not as hot as they would have hoped for. It's a lot less than I thought, said Allison Goodwin from Horsham, Pennsylvania. She's a shopper. It's like any other weekend in December, according to another person and someone else in the crowd. All of this, what's really happening? You know, if you've gone shopping, you have eyes on the situation, and you may be able to make a more accurate judgment than you can get from me or from anyone who's writing about this on a national basis. But the thing that's important to me, or the thing that's interesting to me, is this man, Barry Reichholz, again from Reichholz Wealth Management. He essentially said in a video interview, you can't count on any of the numbers that are being put out by the National Retail Federation because the numbers, they have a history, and he lists them going back over the past 6-8 years, and they routinely make projections that are completely mistaken, not off by a little bit, off by a lot. They've projected that sales would be up 22% 1 year, and they're actually only up 4%. They projected another year sales would be up 10%. They were actually off by 0.5%, down by 0.5%. You can't rely on these numbers, and it illustrates a problem that we have with retail associations now as well as with the government. Where do we get accurate numbers? Where do we get accurate numbers, particularly real time? You would think that we could, with computers and everything else that takes place, you'd think that we should be able to get real-time numbers without too much trouble, and in fact, they'll take weeks or months to find out what real numbers are. And the government does this routinely. They will post a number, and they'll say, oh, the unemployment rate is such and such, the inflation rate is such and such, and then a month or 6 weeks later, they come back and say, oops, we made a mistake, and the real unemployment rate was a little bit higher than what we advised. The real inflation rate was a little bit higher or lower than what we'd previously noted. And then they'll give you another new and improved unemployment rate, another new and improved inflation rate. And a month or so later, they'll say, oops, wait a second, they weren't right either. How can you run the economy without accurate numbers? You know, that's a problem. And how can, particularly, can you run the economy? How can you run the economy not merely if the numbers are inaccurate, but if they're falsified and fabricated? How can you do that? It does not inspire confidence. You know, if you're going to, if the government will tell anyone who, an economist will tell anyone, if you want to hold the economy together, you must maintain confidence. It's probably public confidence in the economy is probably more important than the unemployment rate or the inflation rate. Confidence is what really controls whether the economy is going up, down, or sideways. If it doesn't, if it's not the primary concern, it's certainly a major concern. How do you maintain public confidence in an economy when it's widely known and acknowledged that the government routinely lies about economic indicators? How do you maintain confidence in the economy when it's known, understood, and undeniable that the government manipulates the markets? How do you do that? How do you maintain? Does that inspire confidence, knowing that the government lies about the economic indicators? Does that inspire your confidence or mine? Does it inspire confidence if we know that the government manipulates the markets? And a lot of people will say, the government doesn't. That's just a conspiracy theory. The government doesn't manipulate the markets. And the truth is they've been manipulating the markets by law since the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration brought in what came to be called the Plunge Protection Team. It was the job of the Plunge Protection Team to ensure that any time the markets suffered a significant decline that threatened to go perhaps out of control and really cause a terrible plunge in market prices, that this Plunge Protection Team would step in, shut the market off, and prevent it from declining further. That Plunge Protection Team was established by law all the way back in the Ronald Reagan administration. Well, what is that? They're manipulating the markets. They are controlling, making sure that the prices don't go down too dramatically on any particular day. That's manipulation. It's being done by law. It is not a stretch of the imagination to sit back and say, look, if they've decided by law to prevent the markets from going down too dramatically, why would we suppose that they wouldn't also engage in causing markets to go up? And I'm speaking about the equities markets, the paper, you know, stocks and bonds. Why not? Manipulation is here. It's here by law, and it continues. And the question then is, does that manipulation truly inspire our confidence? And the answer is not clear. You know, we could sit back and say, hooray for market manipulation. Some people would say that. It guarantees that you can't lose money on the stocks. Well, at least on a big day. You can't lose a fortune on a big day. All right? It minimizes your losses. It pretty much guarantees that the stocks will continue to advance. Now, we know that's not true. But we know the influence is there, and it has been encouraging. And some people would say it's like going to a gambling casino where the slot machines are guaranteed to pay off more money than you put into them. For every dollar you put in the slot machines, you get $2 back. Well, that would certainly encourage a lot of us to go gambling, wouldn't it? Because it wouldn't be gambling. We're guaranteed to win. We're guaranteed to win. The plunge protection team, in a sense, guarantees that those who invest in the equities markets and stay there for any length of time are going to win. That was at least the implication. And it worked for a while. But eventually, it undoubtedly contributed to the financial crisis that started in 2007, 2008, with a significant decline in the market. My only point is that while market manipulation may seem to be a great thing for a while, in the long run, it can't be a good thing. It has to sap confidence. Right now, we have the quantitative easing tree, where the Federal Reserve is injecting $85 billion a month into the economy by buying government bonds and also placing funds at the disposal of major financial institutions. That's market manipulation. And the evidence of that is any time the Federal Reserve says, oh, wait a second, I think we're going to taper. Instead of giving them $85 billion a month, we're going to cut down to, well, maybe $75 billion a month. Now, they never named a number on how far they would taper, but I'm just using that as an example. So we're going to taper. And what happens? The markets fall. Okay? The markets have no confidence in their own ability to sustain the current market prices, the current market indices, unless the Federal Reserve and or government are injecting $85 billion a month into the economy. Our confidence is not in the economic might of our nation. Investor confidence is in the ability of the Federal Reserve and federal government to inject currency into the economy. Fiat currency. Currency that is intrinsically worthless. Currency that will inevitably contribute to enormous inflation. If confidence is important, government's behavior does not inspire confidence. I'm Alfred Adask. This is Financial Survival. I'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Job stress, financial obligations, or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. With a discount gold and silver trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family. American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk here on Financial Survival. Melody Cedarstrom is still celebrating Thanksgiving, so I'm here solo in the program by myself. This means I can get into some real trouble now. I can say almost anything I want to say. You know, sometimes I make Melody a little bit nervous. I get off on one subject or another. And I can hear her kind of gasp at the other end. I can hear her in Pennsylvania. She goes, and she's afraid I'm going to say something completely. So far, that I say something that is so politically incorrect that she might have some splaining to do, and she doesn't like that. I enjoy listening to her sometimes, to her occasional gasp. It adds something. It adds something to the program, at least for me. Talk a little about gun rights. Here's an article from the Washington Times entitled New York City Alarms with Notice, quote, immediately surrender your rifle, unquote. The New York City authorities have been sending out notices to residents who own guns that now violate the new ammunition capability laws, demanding they relinquish their weapons. And even though the notifications may be just standard police procedure, the text is a shocker. At issue, weapons that hold more than 5 rounds of ammo. One such notice to a city resident dated November 18th reads, immediately surrender your rifle and or shotgun to your local police precinct and notify this office of the invoice number. The firearm may be sold or permanently removed from the city of New York thereafter. Permanently remove your rifle and or shotgun from New York City. Okay, they've got a new law in New York City that you can only, your rifles and shotguns can't hold more than 5 shots. If you have a shotgun or rifle that's capable of holding more than 5, you've got to surrender to the government, or they have an option to bring your firearm to a licensed gunsmith for a permanent modification and certification proving that it is permanently modified and in compliance. Apparently, New York City wants rifles and shotguns to be fixed, much like we fix or neuter dogs and cats. Would the absence of rifles and shotguns in New York City make people safer and more vulnerable? Safer or more vulnerable? Will criminals, knowing there's no rifle or shotgun in a person's home, be more inclined to break in? And it's not quite true. You can't say that they'll know that there's no rifle or shotgun. But they'll know if you have a rifle or you have a shotgun, it won't have more than five rounds in it. That's what they'll know. I suppose, is this going to make a significant difference? I don't know that it really will. You know, it may be that if you have a shotgun that fires five rounds, and perhaps you used to have one that fired eight or ten, but now it can only fire five. All right, well, what's to keep you from having two shotguns? And now you have the capability of 10 rounds again. Now, you know, some of this is nonsense, some of it's hysteria, but it's evidence of a culture. And it's evidence of a mindset that we might find in New York City. Now, here's another one from Colorado, from a publication, The Truth About Guns. Colorado headline, Colorado State Senator Evie Huttick resigns. The writing was on the wall as the deadline approached. There seemed to be little doubt that the latest recall effort would gather the needed signatures to qualify for a vote. What we're talking about, as you may know, Colorado has already had two recall petitions for state legislators who voted in favor of laws to restrict the right to keep and bear arms in Colorado. And they've had two recall petitions so far, both succeeded and resulted in two state legislators being removed from office. Now, here's a third one named Evie Huttick, and a recall petition has been initiated and was likely to succeed, and the result is the Colorado Democrats were left with two options. Let the vote happen and risk a third defeat, along with loss of control of the state Senate, if Evie Huttick is bounced out of office. A Republican could take her place, and the power and the Democrats' slim control over the state Senate might be lost. The second option is cause State Senator Evie Huttick to resign. If she resigned before she was recalled, this would allow Governor Hickenlooper to appoint another Democrat to her seat. And, of course, the Democrats have chosen the second option. She's going to resign rather than be recalled, and this will allow the governor, who is a Democrat, to replace the Democrat who's resigning with another Democrat. So we're looking. We've got anti-gun legislators in New York City are getting rid of rifles and shotguns, and pro-gun people in Colorado are getting rid of anti-gun legislators. So it's fair to say we have a little bit of polarization in America over gun rights, don't we? Some people really and sincerely believe we've got to get rid of the guns. Some people, like myself, believe we must absolutely hang on to them with both hands. You know, I'm trying to think of his name right now, and I can't. I should be able to. The Hollywood actor, Charlton Heston, who famously stood up and held that flintlock in his hands and said, "Out of my cold, dead hands. You want to take it out of my cold, dead hands." Inspired a lot of people. I would say, instead of holding that flintlock up with one hand, I think I'd hold it up with both hands. And I'd say, take it out of both of my hands, because I'm going to try to hang on as best I can to my firearms. And I recommend you do the same. And part of the reason for that is you can find a document. You can look on the internet. You can find a document that's called the Preamble to the Bill of Rights. Most people don't realize that such a document exists. It was never the official name of the document. The document is essentially a cover letter that was attached to the first 13 amendments that were proposed by Congress. After the Constitution was ratified, shortly thereafter, the Congress proposed 13 amendments and sent them out to the states, and if three-quarters of the states ratified, those proposed amendments would become legitimate amendments to the Constitution. 10 of the 13 amendments were approved by the states, and they became our first Bill of Rights. And the cover letter that went out with these proposed amendments from Congress tells us the purpose of the amendments. And it says the conventions of a number of states having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added. These declaratory and restrictive clauses are the amendments that became our Bill of Rights. The purpose of the Bill of Rights is to prevent misconstruction or abuse of the powers of the Constitution. This is what the federal government, the Congress was saying, this is the purpose for the Bill of Rights. So, who has powers under the Constitution? And the answer is the officers and employees of the federal government. I have no powers under the Constitution. Right? I have powers from other sources, but the Constitution only grants powers to people who are actively involved in the federal government. They are, again, the officers and or the employees of the federal government. They may have powers under the Constitution. I do not. Most of you do not. And the purpose of the Bill of Rights was to prevent misconstruction or abuse of the powers of the Constitution. So who could misconstrue or abuse the powers of the Constitution? I can't. I don't have any powers under the Constitution. I can't misconstrue or abuse those powers because I don't have any. I have rights that are protected by the Constitution, but I don't have powers. Powers are held by, again, federal officers, the president, the members of Congress, the Senate, the federal judges, and so on, plus the employees and the bureaucrats and whatever. They have powers. I do not. The purpose of the Bill of Rights is to prevent misconstruction or abuse of the powers of the Constitution. So the Bill of Rights, which includes the Second Amendment, right, the right to keep and bear arms, it's not there to go duck hunting. It's not there to go deer hunting. It's not there for target practice. The purpose, as expressed by the Founding Fathers when they suggested the Second Amendment in the first place, the purpose for that amendment was to prevent people in the federal government from misconstruing or abusing the powers of the Constitution. The Second Amendment is designed to protect you and me against the federal government. That's what it's here for. And when you understand that, you can see why it's so important that we protect that right to keep and bear arms. It's so important for the American people to do that. It provides our last line of defense against misconstruction or abuse of the powers of the Constitution by the federal government. It is also, similarly, we have polarization on this because people in government say, we don't want to get shot. We don't want them to get shot just because we're engaged in treason. We're getting paid. We're going to move us into a new world order. Everything's going to be great and glorious. We're going to have the people marching around, goose-stepping down the streets. And fascists of the world don't want to get shot. So they want to disarm the people. And if the people are smart, they will always hang on to their right to keep and bear arms with both hands, right? Don't let it be gone. What else have we got to talk about? Let me look at the clock here first. We have 5 minutes. Let's talk about Obamacare, the never-ending story. Here's the health sign-up. Law is delayed for small business. This is from the New York Times. Washington, the Obama administration on Wednesday announced a one-year delay in a major element of the new health care law that would allow small businesses to buy insurance online for their employees through the new federal marketplace. 1 year delay. Why did Obama choose to delay part of Obamacare for another year? Why not 90 days or 6 months? If it were true that Obamacare were so technically flawed, but we can't expect all of it to work for at least another year, why was Obamacare released last month in the first place? Now, let's see. If parts of Obamacare were delayed for another year from today, wouldn't that mean that those parts of Obamacare wouldn't be implemented until after the election in AD 2014? Wouldn't that be true? If parts of Obamacare were delayed until after the next election, would Obamacare be less of an issue in the next election? If so, would the Democrats have an interest in delaying as much of Obamacare as possible until after next year's elections? I think the answer is yes. New York Times article continues. It was another setback for the rollout of the health care law and resulted in part from the well-documented problems of the insurance marketplace website. Now, we've had a problem with the website. Everyone understands that. But now they're saying there's another problem where small businesses can't sign up for a year, sign up on behalf of their employees. They can't sign up for a year. This is a problem other than the website. This is something else. Right? This isn't the website is one problem. This is another problem. And they're laying it off for a year. In the meantime, businesses and their employees can apply through brokers. They can still get at it, but they can't get it through Obamacare. The latest date, coming just after the White House was boasting of major improvements in the health insurance website, opens the door to more complaints about health care and could increase the pressure to delay other provisions. Now, that's what fascinates me. Because what I want to know and what I want to watch for is to see whether other provisions of Obamacare will also be delayed, but not for 90 days, not for 6 months, but for another year. How much of Obamacare needs to be delayed for at least another year and therefore get it back behind the coming elections in order to save the Democrats from mass destruction in the 2014 election? I mean, the Democrats are in a lot of liability right now. Obamacare has been shown to be pretty much of a farce. And as I've pointed out previously on the program, I'm not going to be the least bit surprised if much of Obamacare, maybe not the whole thing, but much of Obamacare is simply deleted. And they just say, never mind, we were just kidding. April Fools, we voted that in. Just kind of have a little fun with you folks out there in TV land. And we're just not going to do Obamacare until, maybe 2020 or sometime, but we're not going to do it right now, at least not fully. I expect Obamacare to collapse under the weight of its own foolishness. And maybe they can avoid that collapse and the embarrassment of the collapse if they postpone a bunch of Obamacare until after the next election. And maybe they can avoid having a catastrophe for the Democrat Party in the 2014 election by making sure that whatever parts of Obamacare that significant parts of Obamacare do not go into effect before the 2014 election and therefore do not antagonize the American people so much that there's a landslide in favor of the Republicans. We shall see. We'll watch and we'll see what happens there. And we'll report and we'll see if it makes any sense, if my suspicions are sensible or unreasonable. We'll see. I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Countries have denied internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a Ku band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4653. 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival Programs brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. Melody is still in a recovery mode from Thanksgiving, so she's not here and I have to do the program all by myself. Here's an article from New York Times. It was written by Paul Krugman. Now, this is an important article from this perspective. Paul Krugman is a Nobel Prize-winning economist who's closely associated with the left end of the political spectrum, the liberal end of the economic spectrum. And when he writes, you know, you got to pay some attention to this. He has credentials and he has a political position, and you can assume when he writes that this is more than just one man's cogitation. I can sit here and talk on this program and give you ideas that seem meaningful to me, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they have, that my ideas carry significance with, or could carry significance with, a broad swath of the American people. Krugman's not like that. When Krugman talks, everyone listens. We don't necessarily agree with what he's saying, but it's important that we pay attention to what he's saying. And the article is entitled, A Permanent Slump. Again, this is in the New York Times. And it starts out, it says, spend any time around monetary officials, and one word you'll hear a lot is normalization. Most, though not all, such officials accept that now is no time to be tight-fisted, that for the time being, credit must be easy and interest rates low. Still, the men in dark suits look forward eagerly to the day when they can go back to their usual job, snatching away the punch bowl whenever the party gets going. In other words, he's talking about the men in dark suits are economists in positions of power in the Federal Reserve, and when the economy gets too hot, then they raise interest rates and they make credit less accessible and they cool down the economy. But for the moment, they can't do that because the economy is in peril. For the moment, we have this normalization where we've been going through an extended period where interest rates are remarkably low, artificially low, unreasonably low, irrationally low, but they're low. And it means that if you can borrow, you can get a heck of a deal. But whether you want to borrow is another story, and whether you can find loans is another story in addition to that. But in general, we've got some remarkably low interest rates for a number of years, 3, 4, 5 years, and this is part of what they're talking about with normalization. And what Krugman goes on, he says, but what if the world we've been living in for the past 5 years is the new normal? What if the depression-like conditions are on track to persist, not for another year or two, but for decades? That sentence is important because here we have Krugman for the second time. He made a similar statement four or six months ago, in one of his articles in the New York Times, where he referred to the current conditions as depression-like. This is an extraordinary admission from a man who would seem to be politically affiliated with the Obama administration. I don't mean they're chummy. I don't mean they have, you know, they meet, they get together and play basketball together and us, but still they have a common, they're sympathetic. They should be sympathetic. And yet here we have Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winning economist, saying, what if depression-like conditions are on track to persist not for another year or two, but for decades? He is admitting that we are in a condition that is depression-like. He's not quite saying, at least not here, he's not quite saying that we're in a depression, but he's saying, you know, it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, so maybe it is a duck. That's a pretty interesting admission. And then he goes on to say, what if these depression-like conditions persist, not for another year or two, but for decades? And he's raising the possibility in this article that that's just what might happen. Now, he's not the first to do so, but it's one thing if I talk about it. It's another thing if Paul Krugman talks about it. The article continues. It says, a number of economists have been flirting with such thoughts for a while, and now they've moved into the mainstream. In fact, the case for secular stagnation, a persistent state in which a depressed economy is the norm, with episodes of full employment few and far between, was made forcefully recently at the most recent ultra-respectable venue, the International Monetary Fund's big annual research conference. Now, Larry Summers at that conference, he argued in favor of this new normal. Right? And they're calling it secular stagnation. Some of you may recall that back during the Carter administration, we had what was called stagflation. The economy did not do well, but there was significant inflation. It's really the worst of all. It's pretty much the worst of all possible worlds. Stagflation, in many regards, is arguably worse than a depression. Right? Depression, things go down. You don't have a job, but on the other hand, prices are down. You don't need a job to the same extent because you can get by working 10 hours a week because prices are dramatically down. You don't make much money. You're in poverty. I understand that. But on the other hand, you get by without too much work. You don't need a lot of work to die because prices are down. In a period of stagflation, you don't have a job. You have less work. You have less employment. Instead of working 40 hours a week, you may be working 30 hours a week or 20 hours a week. But prices are going up in stagflation. Now you're being squeezed. It's one thing if you are not employed or not fully employed. Your wages are going down, but prices for the food and goods and services you absolutely have to have are also declining. And so there's kind of a rough equality there. Your standard of living is going down, but your need to work is also going down. There's a certain fairness in that, perhaps. But the secular stagnation, not stagflation of the Carter era, but secular stagnation that's being referred to by Larry Summers, and also Paul Krugman. prices are not going up. He's not alleging that prices are going up. We don't have stagflation yet, but we have stagnation in that jobs are down. Unemployment is up in a way that is permanent, right? Not just temporary in the sense that it might last for another year or two, but permanent in the sense that it might last for a couple more decades. And that's what they are concerned about. If Mr. Summers is right, everything respectable people have been saying about economic policy is wrong. Summers is right when he says we're sliding into this permanent stagnation, then everything they've been doing has been wrong and will keep being wrong for a long time. And that's according to Mr. Krugman. So where are we going to go with this? Let's take the last paragraph. Larry Summers went on with drew a remarkable moral in his speech. He said, he suggested an economy whose normal condition is one of inadequate demand, of at least a mild depression, and which only gets anywhere close to full employment when it's being buoyed by bubbles. Well, if he's right about this, then we can look at the tech stock bubble, and we can look at the housing bubble, and we can look at a number of different bubbles we've seen or heard about in the markets. I wonder if the purpose of the bubbles is simply to shore up an economy that's been in trouble for how long now? How long have we had these problems? It's not just since 2008. The bubbles go back. We've had these bubbles, especially the real estate bubble, the tech bubble. We can probably point to what Summers would agree were bubbles. We can probably find evidence of them for 10, 15, maybe even 20 years into our past. Does that mean, does that imply, if Larry Summers is correct, does that mean that this economy has been in a state of mild depression for most of 20 years? And the answer could easily be yes. You know, at first glance, most people say, no, that's a crazy idea. That couldn't possibly be. But yeah, it could, really. There have been reports, studies that indicate that the average American standard of living has not increased since the 1970s. We're making more money, but we're paying more taxes. We're going deeper into debt. Our real standard of living has not improved in 40 years. That's consistent with the description we get from Larry Summers and the article that we're getting from Paul Krugman. Are we in a permanent state of stagnation? And if the problem is inadequate demand, that's what they're complaining about. Is it really an inadequate demand? Is it a question where I just decide, well, I don't need to buy any of those gigas. I'm not going to go shopping on Thanksgiving Day, and I'm not going shopping on Black Friday. Nothing I need out there. You know, you get to a point in life where you actually appreciate a pair of socks. Oh, look. Aunt Jean sent me a pair of socks. Or maybe some more underwear or something. You know, you used to hate those kind of gifts when you were a kid and when you were younger. But you get to a point in life where you begin to realize that's not such a bad idea. You know. Some fresh socks, some fresh underwear. Actually, yeah, that's something I can actually use. So is this evidence that I am no longer demanding the goods that I once demanded when I was younger? Is that what's happening? Or is it evidence that the government has taxed us and subjected us to such a low standard of living by its mismanagement of the economy, and by raising taxes, we don't have the money to go out and buy all the gewgaws that we might otherwise be attracted to buy? It's not just a question of, gee, I don't have an interest in buying a new Xbox. It may be that, gee, I can't afford to buy a new Xbox. My employment is down. I used to work 40 hours a week, and I made pretty good money, and now I'm only working 25 hours a week, and I don't know what I'm going to do here, but I can't afford a new Xbox. Why is the demand down? Again, Larry Summers, he's the guy who was, he was the alternate candidate to be chairman of the Federal Reserve. Janet Yellen is going to get the position, but Larry Summers was considered. So this guy's no, he knows what he's talking about. He should know what he's talking about in his allegations. He says the normal condition now is one of inadequate demand, but why? Are we not buying because we have lost our interest in the products that are for sale, or are we not buying because we've been taxed to a point where we can't afford to buy even if we love the stuff? He said, boy, I can't wait to get myself a new car. Love a new car. Want one. I drive around, hang my arm out the window, and cruise around, let everybody know how prosperous I was. Love that. But I can't do it because I'm not that prosperous. I'm not even prosperous enough to fake being prosperous. And therefore, I'm not even thinking about buying a new car, and therefore demand is down. Why am I not being prosperous? And one of the answers is because of rising taxes. I talk about this every so often on the program. I wrote an article on this back in the 1990s called Big, when I did some research, and I discovered I called the local library and found, asked them what the rate of taxation was back in the 1950s when I was a little boy. I found out that my dad, he was paying about 15% of his gross went into local, state, and federal taxes. And at the time in the 1990s, it was about 55% of young man's gross in the 1990s, 40 years later. Young man is paying about 55% of his income in the form of taxes, local, state, federal, and hidden taxes that are built into all the products we buy. If you're paying, my dad got, my sister and I could stay home, my mother could raise me and my sister at home, because my dad was able to keep 85 cents out of every dollar he earned. Young man today gets to keep, or 1990s, got to keep 45 cents out of every dollar he earned. His wife has to work. Why? Because of higher taxes. She has not come a long way, baby. She has not been liberated. She has to take up the strain because hubby has been taxed to a point, right now probably paying 60, 65, maybe 70% of his income is going to taxes. He doesn't make enough to support a family by himself anymore. She has to work in order to help support that family. And that means she can't stay home the way my mother did to raise me and my sister. And the implication on all of this is the primary reason for two workers in a family and the financial stress that's being placed on families is excess taxation by the government. They are taxing us into poverty where we can't afford to buy anything. We can't barely afford to support ourselves or our family. It's flowing from taxation. And it's something I want all of you, I hope all of you will pay a little attention to, and remember and begin to understand. Something needs to be done. Taxes need to be reduced, and reduced dramatically. I'm Alfred Addis. I'm out of time for this week. We'll be back on Monday. I'll be here with Melody in the meantime. I want to thank all of you for listening. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, and Frank, the producer. Bye-bye.
I work all night. I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it? There never seems to be a single penny left for me.
Not too bad.
In my dreams, I have a plan.
If I got to be a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work at all. I'd fool around and have a ball.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Order Doc Mike's book, How to Practice Medicine Without a License. Be your own doctor for only $14.95, plus $2 postage and handling. Call Doc Mike direct at 708-488-8887 or go to wakeupwell.org. That's wakeupwell.org to order Doc Mike's book, How to Practice Medicine Without a License. Be your own doctor for only $14.95. plus $2 postage and handling, or call 708-488-8887. That's 708-488-8887. Order now.